Have you ever decided to give someone a constructive criticism, some suggestion you thought would be helpful to them, and perhaps they might even appreciate your insights into how they might be better in some way? And when you tried that, could you find yourself really appreciating poor Hagar the Horrible in this little strip where he's got all these arrows coming at him and he says, some people just can't take criticism. By the way, do I need to turn on this microphone? I do. There we go. Well, you ever been there, done that? And sadly, when people so often are defensive when it comes to responding to criticism, the response is, well, I'm just not going to criticize anybody. I'm not going to tell them what I really think. And frankly, I had a mom, still do, I have a mom, 93, as Mo told you earlier. When I was growing up, she said, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all. Any of you have a mom like that, taught you that? Well, I want you to say, the more I thought this through, if you mean by that you don't ever give anybody constructive feedback, then that is not only unhealthy, but it is unbiblical. Because we're told over and over again in the Scriptures to admonish one another. And what is that but giving somebody some constructive feedback that they need to hear? So, does criticism always have to be a bane? Or can it and should it be a blessing? I believe it can and should be a blessing. And if you'll look in your notebook of handouts we have, you will notice that one of the pages, page 14, is a interactive outline that I'd like for you to look at and go through. And I think it will help you greatly as we navigate through this very important material. Years ago, I ran across a book I'd highly recommend to you. It's called, by Dr. Lewis Lung, called How to Avoid Physical Divorce by Avoiding Emotional Divorce. And he basically had a simple premise. He says, you get married because you're drawn together and you have these close emotional bonds. And then something happens to sever those emotional bonds that eventually causes you to wind up wanting to sever the relationship. And so he did all this research trying to demonstrate and find out what is it that severs these emotional bonds that is more likely to cause someone to go from wanting to be married and bonded together in a beautiful ceremony to go through some sort of acrimonious divorce. And he came up with a lot of different answers, but the number one most affirming thing to me about this was he said that the number one thing that basically severs emotional bonds in a marriage is chronic caustic criticism. And he made this statement. He said, the day that your spouse stops being your greatest fan and cheerleader and becomes your greatest critic is the day the bloom is off the rose. That is so true on so many levels. And I got to thinking about it. At that time, I was in my mid-30s when I put this lesson together the first time, and I had never heard a sermon on this subject that I can recall. And I thought, wow, this is such an important, critical aspect of life. And surely the Bible has much to say about it. And indeed, it does. It doesn't use the word constructive criticism, but it certainly uses the word admonish and other things that are really one and the same. So what we're going to do today is basically three things. I'm going to look at some biblical instructions about this subject. Then we're going to look at how to give constructive criticism. And it's important to be in an authentic relationship, open with one another, and to give each other feedback. By the way, feedback is the breakfast of champions. Seriously, I mean, if you really want to grow and learn, you want to be open to feedback. The Bible calls that being easily entreated. People can come to you, and you're not defensive. It's one of the characteristics especially important for shepherds. So, how do you give criticism, and how do you receive constructive criticism, which is often difficult to do? So, let's start with Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount. Very familiar text, which actually deals with this subject, if you look at it very closely. Jesus says, and why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye? We could read that wife's eye or husband's eye, right? But do not notice the log in your own eye. You know, years ago I heard about a fellow who came to a marriage counselor. And the counselor said, "Well, what can I do for you today?" And he says, "Well, I'm here today to confess my wife's faults." Well, at least he was honest about his agenda. But the problem is, if you focus only on the other person's problems, the specks that you see in their eye, and the only way this relationship is going to get better in your mind is if this person changes, you're usually not going to be very successful in bringing about a positive end result. So Jesus says, don't focus on the speck in your brother's eye, or your wife's eye, or your family member's eye. First, look in the mirror and see what kind of things you might be able to do to improve. Oh, how can you say to your brother or your son or your spouse, "Let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own. You hypocrite." First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly enough to take the speck out of your wife's eye. Right? I mean, that's the way you can read this, and I think as a result get a lot of benefit from it. The problem, I think women, frankly, have more of an issue with this than men, is they'll date some fella, and they kind of look at him, and, you know, maybe he's handsome, and she's attracted to him, and she thinks, you know, this guy has potential. And it's kind of like a real estate investor that's looking for a fixer-upper. You know, you look at this person and, you know, and you think, well, you know, if you change this and change that, you know, I might actually make some money off of this. It might get marketable. If you approach somebody with the idea of I'm going to fix them and then we'll be happily married, normally does not go well. For the most part, what you see is what you get when you're dating. And if you're not happy with the character of that person, then back off and find someone else that you are more likely to be happy with. But there's this natural impulse to look at the other person and think about how they need to change. Where Jesus says, don't do that. First, look in the mirror. And behold, the beam in your own eye. So, when you deal with this subject, what we need to understand is, first, you don't look primarily at the other person, but you look to self. That is so important. And the whole answer, however, is not to deal with oneself alone. After you've honestly looked in the mirror and tried to assess your own part in this, I do marriage counseling. I say, what percentage of this marriage trouble that you guys are having do you think is your fault, and what do you think is the other person's fault? I'll ask them this privately so they're not hearing what the other person says. Nobody says 100% zero. You know, most people will say, oh, 70-30, you know, 60-40, whatever. They'll give some percentage, and I'll say, okay, let's just assume this is 70% your spouse's fault and only 30% your fault. Okay, let's just assume that's accurate. By the way, you talk to the spouse and they probably think it's the reverse, right? But at any rate, I'll say, okay, let's just own up to your 30%. What's the 30% that you honestly can say you could do better on and that you can understand is your role in the problem you're having? And then I ask them to begin the session by humbly apologizing for their part in this and just humbly admitting their errors. Now, neither one of them knows what percentage the other party gave as far as who's most at fault. But the point is, when you start off humbly admitting your own portion and taking ownership of the part of this that you've done that you know you shouldn't have, it's amazing how it brings about humility. And then they both begin to bond right away as you start off with each taking ownership of their own role in this that needs to be corrected. And that's what Jesus is saying here, you know. You want to look first at your own issues. But that doesn't mean that you don't need to talk to your spouse about these things that are causing issues for you as well. If you're going to have an authentic relationship, you need to have honest communication. The Bible says in Proverbs 27, verse 6, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are profuse." You know, again, nobody likes to hear criticism, but if you're in sin, for example, are you saying or doing things that are really offensive and hurtful? It may hurt to hear, but if that gets the person's attention, that's a faithful friend who tells you the truth instead of just being some sort of yes man or yes woman. It reminds me of a surgeon's scalpel. You know, years ago, my dad had to have surgery to take 18 inches of cancer out of his colon, and it was a pretty dramatic surgery. And I know that there was a long recovery period, and you know those scalpel marks hurt and leave a scar. But he went on to die of something completely unrelated, and it completely got rid of the cancer, and it gave him probably another 40 years on his life. Those are fateful wounds. You know, maybe it hurts to have the scalpel go in, but if it gets rid of cancer that's going to kill you if you don't get it out, boy, that's the best wound you ever had. And sometimes in relationships, we need to understand that's what's involved in a loving admonishment. It takes courage to do what Paul said in Romans 15 and verse 14 when he says, "Be filled with goodness and knowledge, able to admonish one another." That word admonishment means to warn or to instruct in a way that will build a person up, especially spiritually. So, when you see the word admonition in Scripture, and it's found everywhere, think, give constructive criticism to people who need it. And so, silence may be golden, but sometimes it's just plain yellow. Sometimes you do need to speak up and call out something that needs to be dealt with, rather than just taking the Christian dimmer light and turning it perhaps all the way down. So lots of references to this, particularly in the Proverbs. Why are there so many references to this in the writings of Solomon? Well, he lived with 1,000 women in his harem. How the wisest man that ever lived wound up choosing to live with 1,000 women, I will never know. It was life's greatest irony, I think. But at any rate, you can imagine that was a challenge. And so he has lots to say about that. He says in Proverbs 12 and verse 1, "Whosoever loveth instruction loveth knowledge, but he that hateth reproof or instruction is stupid." Boy, that's really blunt, isn't it? The idea in the American Standard, it says, is brutish. In other words, you're like a dumb animal. Only a dumb animal won't listen to feedback and then learn and hopefully do better. Proverbs 12:15, "He that hearkeneth unto counsel is wise, but the way of a fool is right in his own eyes." You ever heard anybody say, "Nobody's going to tell me what to do"? I mean, that is such a foolish statement, because we all need help from others. Proverbs 23:12, "Don't refuse criticism. You will end in poverty and disgrace. If you accept criticism, you're on the road to fame." All right. Also, Proverbs 25:12, "He wears a badge of honor who accepts the badge of reproof." And it's not just the Old Testament. In the New Testament, Ephesians 4:15 admonishes us to speak the truth in love. Now let's be honest. Someone asks us something, particularly in a family situation, sometimes if you answer honestly, it may be somewhat critical of the way the person did this. And so we're supposed to speak the truth, even if it's perhaps maybe not that complimentary, but it needs to be done in love. And what we need to do is remember that all of us are imperfect, right? Nobody's a perfect husband, father, mother, wife, child. We're all imperfect. So we all need help to grow and do better. And so every relationship needs feedback so they can do better and learn better how to meet their spouse's needs and understand them. We all need help from others who periodically can shed light on our blind spots. Proverbs 16 verse 2 says, "All the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes, but Jehovah weigheth the spirits." In other words, we tend to, you know, defend our own behavior and act like that, you know, we know what's best. But God is looking down, and ultimately He knows what's going on. And we need to make sure we're honest with ourselves as we move forward and hopefully grow in our relationships. We all have blind spots, and we need to recognize that. If you're traveling down the interstate, and you put your blinker on, and you're getting ready to turn into the right lane, one of the problems is frequently, even if you turn around and check, there can be a little car or a motorcycle or something in that blind spot. And so, you know, true story, going down the interstate, you turn right, there's a fella in the back seat. He happens to turn around as well when he sees your blinker on. And he sees that car that you missed, but he doesn't say anything. And so you go ahead and change lanes, almost run into this motorcycle that's behind you, and you have to swerve back in because you know there was a horn and all this stuff. And it was just a really horrendous moment. And the fellow in the back seat says, I saw that coming. And, you know, and you're the driver and you say, well, if you saw it and I didn't, why didn't you say something? Well, my mama always told me, if I don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all. And the driver is thinking, you know, how foolish is that? We almost had a terrible accident. You were looking at it from a different perspective. You saw something I didn't see. I needed your insight and your feedback. There are times when you shouldn't worry about being a backseat driver. And it's so true that we often do not see how our children see us. We don't see how our actions are perceived. And we need somebody else to love us and to care enough about us to sit us down in love and help us to learn how we can do better. So what's the problem here when it comes to getting feedback or getting admonitions or giving admonitions? I want to suggest the problem is not criticism, but destructive criticism. And hopefully all of us appreciate helpful feedback, right? But we don't appreciate somebody who's just nitpicking at us in order to kind of put us down. So we've got to build up and not tear down. Now, one of the things that will help us in this, and I want to start off with this challenge, is I do this in my premarital counseling. And regardless of how long someone's been married, I really highly recommend you take this criticism pledge. The criticism pledge is this. I promise as your mate, I will never speak ill of you to friend, family, or stranger. I will not embarrass or belittle you in front of others, nor will I be critical of you in your absence. I will not discuss our personal problems with anyone without your permission. This is my pledge to you. Now, I can't tell you how important this is in maintaining trust in a marriage. It's really nice to know that if my wife is around a bunch of other women and they start complaining about their husbands, that my wife will not pile on and that my name is safe. It's not that she couldn't find something critical to say about me. I guarantee you she could, you know, faults are self-evident, right? And our spouses know our faults and our idiosyncrasies. But we've made this promise to one another, and I know that she is not going to talk about something like that without my permission first. Similarly, when men are around and they start talking about women, and you've been in those conversations where men say, oh, women, you can't live with them, you can't live without them, you know, and all these kind of things that are often said negatively about one gender against the other, which is very unproductive. Well, she knows that I am never going to say anything negative about her to other people. And if we've got a problem, we'll talk about it together first and then go to someone to discuss that problem where we've agreed together that's what we're going to do. Now, why do you make that pledge to each other? It's not because there's nothing that you could say about your spouse in a moment like that, and you may be tempted to pile on and do so. But you don't do so because of your loyalty to each other and to the relationship. Let me tell you what so frequently happens. A couple has a fight about something, major disagreement. Join the club. Every marriage has bumps in it. The problem is, the man or the woman, maybe the woman gets on the phone, she needs somebody to talk to. So she calls her mama. And she complains to her mother about her husband. And the husband doesn't know. But the problem is what you've talked to a relative about or to one of your best friends about, that winds up getting repeated. What you say, for better or for worse, about another person is almost always repeated. And eventually that gets back to the husband, and he learns that his spouse, or in this case the wife, is talking behind his back about a problem. And that winds up being a bigger withdrawal from the love bank than the problem itself. And it's just a great sense of betrayal and causes all this drama. Yeah. You know, my parents, very wise people. I remember my dad when I first got married. I was 24 years old. And Well, it'd be a whole sermon on the little speech he gave me that day before my wedding day. Very meaningful advice. And one of the things he told me is, he said, you and Gail are at times going to have differences and disagreements. But I'm telling you right now, we do not want you calling us up complaining about your wife. You work it out between the two of you. He said, the problem is, we love you, you're our son, we'll be sympathetic, we're only hearing one side of the story, and then you two will work it out and we'll still have hard feelings about this thing. Don't do that to us or to your marriage. I wasn't planning on doing that anyway, but wow, that was good counsel. And you would be surprised how much difficulty and problem is caused by people not following this principle. Don't talk negatively about your spouse without their permission. What do I mean by that? You know what? I'm a little concerned about this issue. Can I talk to Brother so-and-so and get their counsel on this? And if the person says sure, then you have their permission to talk about it. Right? The only exception would be if you're dealing with sin and it's a Matthew 18 issue and you've gone to your husband, say, and he's sinning, and well, you may need to get witnesses, and that may be done without his permission. So you've got a biblical reason there when you're dealing with something clearly sinful to violate this. But other than that, this criticism pledge is very, very important. So regardless of how long you've been married, be loyal to one another and understand the importance of this principle. So how do you criticize constructively? Well, let me suggest you do it so that you believe the other person is emotionally ready to accept it. You know, because a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. I mean, it's timing is everything. And so how do you know when your spouse is ready to accept some feedback, some constructive criticism about something? Well, this may not sound very profound, but I think the key is to get their permission first. This is how it works. My wife and I are having a meal, and the kids are dismissed, and just me and her. And I say, honey, there's something that's been on my mind. I want to give you a suggestion that I think might help you with your parenting. Is now a good time, or would you rather talk about it later? Gail would look at her watch. I think she's worried about a sermon coming, maybe. Anyway, she'd look at her watch and she'd say, well, now's not a good time. I said, okay, you let me know when you're ready. So I'll go down the hall to my study typically, and curiosity is an absolutely wonderful thing. You know, the wheels are turning and she's wondering, well, what it is that Brent wants to say to me. And so, sure enough, 15, 20 minutes later, she'll come down the hall and she'd go, okay, now what is that you wanted to talk to me about? And then I'll look at my watch. And I'll go, it's okay. It doesn't have to be done now. She'll go, no, I want to know. Tell me. Listen, folks, she's begging for it. The worst thing you can do is, get upset with your spouse and say, hey, you know what your problem is? It's not the best way to begin a conversation. The other person's ready to put up their dukes and defend themselves. Versus respectfully recognizing these are sensitive matters. Let them know you've got something that you want to talk about and get their permission. Is this a good time? And then when they say yes, now's a good time, now they're much more likely to be responsive and open to what you have to say. And so my wife and I have this rule. We don't criticize one another unless we get each other's permission. My wife will say, I've got a suggestion about that sermon Sunday. When's a good time to talk about it? I'll say, not now. But the point is, what do you want to tell me, right? It's amazing. How many of you would like to live in a home where you're only affirmed, and then if you're going to have some sort of critical comment made, it's only done on rare occasion, only when needed, and only when you first are given a heads up and given a chance to say yes or no? How many of you would prefer to live in a home like that? I want to tell you, that is a huge benefit. And it has helped many, many people across the country. So, you ask permission first, and then when your spouse says, okay, now, tell me what's on your mind, now you're more likely to have a productive discussion. But once you get permission, okay, what's on your heart? What do you want to suggest? It would help me be better husband, wife, whatever. What you need to do is don't give an overdose. a common failure is to pour it on. Again, maybe you can relate to this Hagar the Horrible strip. You know what your trouble is? What? Better sit down and get comfortable. You want this list in alphabetical order or topically indexed? Which would you prefer? See, the problem is, if you say, I've got a problem I want to talk to you about, and you come in with, and another thing, and another thing, and another thing. You know, if my wife gives me five things that she wants me to change, that she's upset with me about, all at once, all that does is kill the motivation to do anything. I mean, I feel like saying, hey, I'm a human being, I've only got two arms, I'm not an octopus, I can't handle five things at once. I mean, but what you need to do instead is make sure you approach this with affirmation. If my wife says, honey, you know I love you and you're a wonderful husband and I know you mean well and all of that, and I don't want to hurt your feelings, but this really bugs me when after you shave you don't completely wipe out the sink and then I come and have to clean up after you like you're a little kid. Do you think you could work on being more careful about not doing that? Yeah, honey, I'm so sorry. I need to be more considerate. Thanks for letting me know. See, if it's in an atmosphere of affirmation and then there's just one thing at a time, most people can handle that well and it's productive. But if it's just this long list, you just kind of give up and you say, I'm not perfect, there's no pleasing this woman, and you go on. So, don't overdose. The solution, in my judgment, is to make sure you deal with only one criticism at a time. It's very, very important. In fact, I suggest that you limit your criticisms to only one criticism a week. Remember, Proverbs 17, verse 9 says, he that harpeth on a matter separates chief friends. I did this lecture many years ago at a marriage seminar. It was kind of a more informal kind of a thing. And there was a couple sitting right there at this marriage seminar. And I made this observation, and the woman looked at me, and she goes, like, you've got to be kidding me. You were limiting me to once a week. I stopped, and I said, ma'am, that is 52 times a year. Isn't that enough constructive feedback to give your husband every year? And the husband's over here going, oh. Anyway, one criticism a week is oodles. We've got to listen carefully and increase our awareness. So what's the solution? Well, Dr. Lung, in his book about how to avoid physical divorce by first avoiding emotional divorce, he says that he recommends that every family, not just couple, but family, goes through what he calls a 24-hour criticism fast. Now, we usually think about a fast as going a certain amount of time without food. But this is going a certain amount of time without criticism. Not because you ought to live a life without ever giving constructive feedback. We've already talked about that. That's not the solution. The problem is people often are giving too much critical feedback and not enough positive feedback. The ratio you want to shoot for is about 10 to 1. You can have 10 compliments that are sincere and meaningful and only one occasional constructive suggestion. You're probably doing well and are getting along really well. So here's the 24-hour criticism fast. For a period of 24 hours, refrain from criticizing yourself. You know, we all have what's known as an internal thought language. They call it self-talk. You need to be aware of your self-talk. And people that are very critical are usually also very critical of themselves. So start being your own best friend. Stop putting yourself down all the time, and it will help you to be less likely to be critical of others. This next is the one that's really hard for me, not to criticize the government and all the crazy things that they do. The food, your boss, your coworkers, your spouse, your surroundings, you come to a complete halt for 24 hours, and you watch out for backseat driving and comments on other drivers. Phone calls can be dangerous. Here's the rule. You cannot criticize anyone for any reason unless human life is in danger. Another exception would be someone on the fast criticizing without realizing it. And so in that case, you might point out to your brother and sister here at Tinsboro that, we're on a criticism fast. That was critical. You need to start over. So it's okay to hold each other accountable in that way. This is not as easy as it sounds. believe me, again, when I gave this challenge out at that marriage seminar, this lady jumped up and she said, "I'll have no trouble, but he'll never make it." I said, "Ma'am, we are a split second into this fast and you already have to start over." And she goes, "Oh." And then the husband goes like this with the elbow, and I said, "You've got to start over." You know, and the whole place was in stitches. They didn't even realize it, but they started off at the get-go violating the fast by putting the other party down. When I first gave this fast challenge to the congregation at North Street where I used to preach, one of the sisters there worked in the bookstore there at Florida College, where I was an administrator at the time. And I talked to her about 12 noon that day. And I said, "Pam, how's it doing? You feeling okay?" She says, "Well, no, I'm not doing very well, Brother Hunter." I said, "Why is that?" She says, "I've been at work since 9 a.m. for 3 hours. I've been really careful not to be critical. And people keep on coming up to me and asking me if I'm okay. You know, are you feeling all right?" I go, "People think I'm sick because I've stopped being critical." I said, "Really, Pam?" I go, "That's really bad." She goes, "Yeah, it is. And you know what? You need to start over too." I mean, this is not as easy as it sounds, but it is worth doing. If you find yourself being critical, make a note of the time, start your fast over again until you've gone for 24 hours, including the time you are asleep and without being critical at all. Now, the Ledfords are here. You may remember me giving this in communication theory, the same criticism fast. And some students would come to me 2 weeks later just saying, "Please, can I stop? There's no way that I can get through 24 hours without criticizing." I go, "Keep it up. It's a very important discipline and awareness for you to learn. Why should you try? Because it will increase your awareness of how critical everybody is around you. Secondly, it will help you to become aware of your own compulsion to criticize and how far off most of us are to that 10-to-1 ratio I mentioned earlier. It will enable you to experience the power of self-mastery, and most importantly, so you can lay a foundation of love and acceptance in your home instead of rejection. How can you stop being so critical if you're not even aware that you are critical or a critical person? So that's why this exercise is so important. And then when you start to think about something critical, you need to catch yourself and say, "Wait a minute, I need to ask permission first. Make sure the other person is emotionally ready to accept it. That's what I want, so that's the golden rule. That's what I'm going to do for them." It's just such a simple principle and could really make such a difference in the family. All right, so let me ask you a question here. This is a volunteer army, right? How many of you will commit to the 24-hour criticism fast? It's quarter to four, let's say from 5 p.m. today to 5 p.m. tomorrow. How many of you are ready to do it? Come on, let me see your hands. Okay, I know some of you are not raising your hand. Come on, you in the green hair? Come on, raise your hand. He says no. Well, let me tell you something, my friend. Those who are most reluctant are the most likely to need this exercise. I mean, I did this at North Street, and it was just a riot. One person, who was normally not this kind of person, they met me at the door, and they said, "That criticism fast you just asked us to go on, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard." I said, "Do you realize you're just a few minutes after I've given it, you're criticizing the criticism fast? Do you think maybe you ought to rethink this, and maybe this is something that would be really good for you to do?" It was really interesting. It's fun and insightful. And people often say, "Well, you know, this isn't a criticism, it's just the truth." Listen, if it's a negative truth, those are the kind that hurt the most, right? We're not just talking about, you know, gossip or something that's made up. But it is fun and insightful. And I want you to know, the ultimate challenge is to ask for it. I mean, husbands can ask their wives, "I'd like you to give me one thing that you think I could work on this week that would help me be a better husband." And wives can ask their husbands, "Give me one suggestion that would help me to be a better wife and meet your needs." I found it very useful when I first read about this in Dr. Lund's book. I went to my two children. Amy was about 13 at the time, my oldest daughter, and Allison was about 12. And so I would my pattern was is to say a prayer with them every night before they went to bed. That was my special father-daughter time with them. And I said to each of them, I said, Amy, I'm really working hard on being a better dad. And I honestly would like your feedback. How do you think I could be a better dad? And without any hesitation, she said, I know. I kind of took a deep swell. Okay, tell me, what do you think I need to do to be a better dad? And she goes, triple my allowance. I said, well, that really wasn't the kind of thing I had in mind. Well, you asked me for my feedback, Dad. And I said, okay, all right. So that was her feedback. Then I went to Allison. I said, Allison, I really want to be a better dad. How do you think I can be a better dad? And she says, oh, Dad, you're doing fine. I said, well, thank you, Allison, but you know, I want you to think about it, and I want you to know I'm open to your feedback if you think I can do things better. So she says, okay, we prayed about it. Then about a week later, she said, you know, Dad, you were asking about how you could be a better dad. I said, yeah, of course. She said, well, Mom and I were talking about it. Oh, you were you? Yes, Mom and I were talking about it, and we think that sometimes you can be a little defensive. I said, really? I said, okay, can you give me some examples? She gave me a couple of examples. And it was really important not to be defensive about somebody telling you that you're defensive. Right? And I said, okay, I can see your point. Let's pray about this together, and let's have God help Dad do better in this. So we prayed about it together. And then a couple of weeks later, she says, Dad, you know, you've been, you know, working on being not so defensive. I go, yes. She goes, well, Mom and I have been talking, and we think you're doing a whole lot better. I said, she does, huh? Well, I'm glad she does. So we prayed about that, and we thanked the Lord for helping me improve in that area. Now, those are the kind of communication exchanges that help your kids be open and honest, particularly when they're teenagers, that you want to have a good, healthy family life. And so let me just suggest, go up to our shepherds here and say, I know you guys have a very responsible job. You take it really seriously. What can I do to help lighten your load? What can I do to help be a member here that helps your oversight here be one with joy and not grief? Wouldn't that be a great thing if members started coming up and asking me that? I'd highly recommend it. I mean, I think if we follow these principles, you'd probably avoid most all church splits. Because so many things are done in situations among church families where we're talking about people behind their back and it comes back to cause division. So how do you give criticism? Well, you couple criticism with compliments. I want you to notice the ratio found in Revelation 2, 1 through 4. Paul is talking to the church at Ephesus and he gives them a string of compliments. And he says, I know thy toil and thy patience, and you've not grown weary. So it starts off with statements of affirmation. And then he says in verse 4, but nevertheless, I have this against you. You've left your first love. See, so he gives three compliments to one criticism. The bitter pill of criticism can be swallowed much easier if first sugar-coated with the medicine of sincere praise. Remember Mary Poppins? A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. The key is it has to be sincere. And you don't want to only compliment when there is a criticism following the compliment. You want to compliment as often as you can. 10-to-1 ratio is what you want to focus in on. So, how do you receive it constructively? What happens when you're on the other end of this? Well, let me suggest that the first words out of your mouth be, thank you for coming to me and talking to me about this. Now, most of the time when someone criticizes us, the last thing on our mind is to thank them. But I think that's really important. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 18 says, in everything, give thanks. Does that include when someone is criticizing you? Well, does that include... Everything is pretty all-inclusive, is it not? And frankly, there's lots of reasons to give thanks. If the person came to you face to face, that takes courage. It's easier to talk behind your back. If they came and talked to you face to face, thank them for coming to you directly instead of talking to you behind your back. If this is true and I need to change, then you've helped me. Thank you. You're a faithful friend. Now I can grow. And if this is false or just a misunderstanding, as it often is, this gives me an opportunity to correct that misunderstanding. I didn't mean that at all when I said that. I meant this. Oh, I misunderstood. Now it's resolved. But what happens if you don't go to people when you're offended? You continue to be offended and you feel badly toward the other person, and the other person doesn't even know what's wrong. That's not fair. That doesn't make for close relationships. And always ask, what can I learn from the criticism? Not all criticism is valid, but you can all still learn something from all kinds of criticism and take action if possible. In the case of Amy, Gail and I, we had a little family conference, and Amy really wanted to have more money, but we didn't want to give her a bigger allowance. So we came up with some additional chores, some things she could do to earn more money and teach her some, you know, industriousness. And she liked it. I liked it. Some of the chores she started doing were things that I would normally do. There was a win-win on all fronts. And we had a conversation about it. So take action if possible. And I really like this little statement. For years, my wife and I had this up on our refrigerator. Don't mind criticism if it is not true. Disregard it. If it is unfair, keep from irritations. If it is ignorant, smile. If it is justified, learn from it. Now, before we have our break, I want to give you a little quick review. I guess this is the teacher in me. Let's go back and make sure we got these main points. If you're having a problem with another person, who do you focus on first? They're part of the problem or you're part of the problem? Yeah, focus on self first. Try to be honest about that. Then you can go ahead and get the speck out of the other person's eye. Remember, Jesus says you're supposed to get the speck out of the other person's eye. And if you've got a speck in your eye, that's kind of a problem. If someone helps you get the speck out, are they your friend or are they your enemy? Are they your friend? Just keep everything in perspective. And then, if you want to talk to the person about the speck in their eye, before you do that, what do you get first? Their permission, right? Is this a good time? Can I talk to you about this? And then after they say yes, you make sure you don't what? Pile on. Don't give an overdose. How many criticisms at a time? One. No more often than what? Once a week. And then later on, when you've been married for a long time, you can change that to once a month. And now, fortunately, because we know the door is always open to talk to each other, we can go months and months and months and months without any criticism of each other at all. But it's not phony. It's just unnecessary. Because over the years, you have become compatible. Now, if you're receiving criticism from someone else, instead of being defensive, what's the first thing you say? First words out of your mouth? Thank you for coming to me. And that's not what the person's going to expect, but that's being easily treated. Now, the easiest and simplest way to dramatically improve the atmosphere in the home is making a determination to limit criticism, especially chronic caustic criticism. It's a very potent force. It can either push us apart or pull us together. You know, research has shown that it's the positives that initially attract us to our spouse. Want to go out with them, want to date them. But it's the negatives that inevitably come up in how we deal with them or don't deal with them that will push us apart. And that's why practical insights about how to deal with the negatives and being forthright about what you like and what you don't like, and that kind of thing, is so important. And so that's going to lead us to the next three lessons, which are going to help us to open up these communications so we can deal with these things. Okay, any thoughts or feedback before we have a break?